Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, designing basements where kids can play and relax. Information at callmosby.com.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we're talking with one of the giants of musical theater. Composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim's name can be found on playbills for such productions as A Little Night Music, Company, Sweeney Todd, and many, many more. He wrote the lyrics for West Side Story and Gypsy. He's been honored with an Academy Award, 8 Tony Awards, 8 Grammy Awards, and the Pulitzer Prize. He's in St. Louis to receive yet another, the St. Louis Literary Award, sponsored by St. Louis University. It's a pleasure to welcome Stephen Sondheim to our studio. Another reward, just what you need for the mantle, right?
I don't have a mantle. I have a low table.
A low table. Well, it's a crowded table, to be sure. Right. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
It's a privilege and a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you. You know, and when I thought about our conversation, I thought about what a pleasure it must be for you to get up every day and realize how many millions of people you have given so much pleasure to over the decades.
Well, I don't think of them, but then when somebody comes up to me and says that, a stranger, then I feel, you know, very pleased. I'm not even proud, just pleased.
Yeah. Well, it's been just an enormously successful career. I don't think it can be matched by anybody, certainly not too many people. But it all got started a little bit differently. From what I've read about you, Steve, the early childhood was not a particularly pleasant one.
No, my parents were divorced when I was 11. And my mother got custody of me, and she was a difficult lady.
Yeah. And you spent a lot of time alone. And what I wanted to get to was, you know, how that lonely childhood really influenced what you became.
I didn't feel lonely. I never did. First of all, I went to boarding schools and summer camp. And so I was surrounded by peers all the time. I was popular and I enjoyed virtually every aspect of them, you know, from academics to sports. So I was not aware that I was lonely. Everybody who's ever talked about my childhood said he was lonely. I guess I must have looked lonely. But when I think back, I didn't feel lonely at all.
Well, when did the music become a part of your life?
I'm not quite sure. When I was 5, 6, 7 years old, I took piano lessons, which is what every nice Jewish boy on the West Side did, and would give little recitals and that sort of thing. And I guess maybe that infiltrated. I got seriously interested in music in my teens. And when I was in prep school, well, I continued piano and I would give concerts around Pennsylvania. And but still, it was passive. I didn't want to compose until I was about 16. And then I started to get the composing bug.
And that led you to the Broadway-type musical productions.
Well, actually, the music that most influenced me at first was movie music. Mm-hmm. I was a big movie buff, and so it was the scores of people like Franz Waxman and Max Steiner and Bernard Herrmann that got me going. Now, of course, movie music is very much influenced by what shall I say, theater music, by which I don't mean musical comedy. I mean everybody from Wagner through Strauss, et cetera, et cetera. So it was through them. And then I started to get into classical recordings. And I collected records, particularly of the 19th century, Romantic era. And so that's how I got immersed. Then I took a course in college my first year. It was an elective course in music. The music department, I went to Williams College. And there were only, at that time, 1,300 students. And the music department consisted of two men, one who taught piano and the other of whom taught composition. And I went, and his name was Robert Barrow. And the very first day I went into the class, he played for us La Mer, the Debussy piece. Mm-hmm. And he said, all right, this is called the C. Does it sound like the C to you? Doesn't sound like the C to me. He said, what this is about is not about the C. It's about the whole tone scale. And he took all the romance out of music and just taught what music was made of as a craft. And I fell in love. And I thought, this is what I want to do with my life. He made it, by taking the romance out, he made it so romantic, I couldn't wait to do it.
What about those who put romance into it, though? If you were a movie buff, people like Jerome Kern, Cole Porter, and George Gershwin, people like that.
Well, I don't know they put romance. First of all, the romance isn't really in the music. It's in the lyrics, if anything. But, you know, oh, I love their stuff because I just, well, they're my favorite composer. You're ticking them off one by one there.
One of the things that I learned in getting ready for our discussion was your association with Oscar Hammerstein, the great lyricist and of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And I gather from what I've read that he was enormously important in your development.
Oh, he was a second father to me. He was a mentor, and he and his wife were sort of surrogate parents because my father had remarried and I didn't see him very much. Except maybe when he had visiting privileges. And my mother and I did not get along. But we lived in Pennsylvania about 3 miles from the Hammersteins. They had a son my age, Jimmy. And so Jimmy and I became great friends. And I found myself spending more time over at the Hammersteins than at home. And Oscar must have sensed something in me that had to do with wanting to write songs. And so I wrote a show in prep school, George School, and I gave it to him to I won't say criticize, but critique, I guess is the word. And he was a producer of other people's shows as well as his own. And so I went to bed that night knowing that in the morning he would call me and say he was going to produce. I was 15 years old. He was going to produce the show, and I'd be the first 15-year-old to have a show on Broadway. And so I went over. And I said, now, you know, I don't want you to treat this as if I was your friend or a friend of the family. Treat this as if it's just a script that crossed your desk and you just read it. He said, oh, in that case, it's the worst thing I ever read. And I saw my lower lip tremble, I guess. And he said, I didn't say it wasn't talented, but if you want to know what's wrong with it, let's start with the first stage direction. And he went through it as if it were a professional script. And I've said often, and I'm given to hyperbole, but I really believe I learned more in that afternoon than most songwriters learn in a lifetime, because I was getting a distillation of this guy's experience, all crowded into 4 hours, 5 hours, and I was, at that age, as many 15-year-olds are, a sponge for knowledge, and I just soaked it all. I can remember things he said that day to this day. And they've all stood me in good stead.
Was this before Oklahoma Carousel, South Pacific?
This was, curious enough, they were writing Carousel at the time. Mm-hmm. Oscar decided that there was going to be, at the end of the first act, when they go off to the island, there was going to be a treasure hunt on the island. And I was very into puzzles, games, and treasure hunts. So I was his his treasure hunt consultant for Carousel.
So that was a real nice clam bake? Is that what came out of all of that?
Yeah, it's supposedly clam bake led into the treasure hunt, but they cut the scene anyway.
Right. How did he inspire you as a lyricist? It seems to me that your lyrics and his are quite different, stylistically.
They're entirely different. Yeah. First of all, inspire is not the word. He taught. But what I did was I tried to, of course, the first lyrics I wrote were all about nature images, you know, willow trees and birds and everything that he wrote about all the time. And he said, you know, you're writing like me. Write what you feel. Don't try to write what I feel. Write what you feel. And I said, well, I'm a city. He said, write what you feel. And he said, if you do, you'll be 99% ahead of the game of the others. He put it in a competitive way so that if I wrote what I felt, I'd be a better lyricist than other people my age. And he was right in the sense that you have to write what you know, and not necessarily the experience, but the feelings. So from that day on, I didn't imitate anybody, including him. And though he was a city boy, which most people can't believe considering the sort of bucolic writing he did, he was a New York boy, and he was articulate and quite often sharp-tongued, not in his work. And so I wrote wrote what I felt and what I observed, and even though it's naive stuff, the age 15, 16, 17, it's still personal. So that's why our styles are entirely different.
It seems to me, and I'm not sure the term is correct, but he was a master of what I call the internal rhyme. Does that make sense to you? Or the
no, he didn't use no, he didn't use very many internal rhymes.
Really, it seems no, to me that was a lot of it.
The field of internal rhyming is Cole Porter and things. Oscar, of course, everybody uses some internal rhymes, but he was not very interested in rhyme. I feel his lyrics are very plain rhymed. You know, it's day and may and say. He wasn't interested in trick rhymes or unusual rhymes or rhymes that pointed attention to themselves, as some of us are, as Cole Porter was, as I sometimes am. But that's just interest. He really tried to imitate the way people talk in rhyme, and people don't talk in elaborate rhymes.
Yeah, I'd like to play a couple of things that you've done. How many songs do you think you've written over the years?
I have no idea.
Would Send in the Clowns be the one that that everyone knows, do you think? And are you tired of people asking you that question?
No, that's true. It's certainly the one enormous hit single I ever had. And so in that sense, yeah. It's a song I like. And yes, I'm tired of hearing it, but it's a song I like a lot.
Would you mind listening to just a few seconds of it?
Just
to remind folks, this is Dame Judi Dench, whom I've never heard sing this before. She performed it in London when she was in A Little Night Music there. Let's listen to a little of her singing it, and then we'll move on.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clouds. Isn't it bliss?
Dame Judi Dench singing Send in the Clowns from A Little Night Music, written by our guest Stephen Sondheim. That one really took off. You've had Frank Sinatra sing it, Judy Collins, Barbara Streisand.
Well, it didn't take off right away. In fact, it was Judy Collins who sort of made it popular. She sang it because it was sort of folky and the kind of thing she sang. And then Sinatra heard that, and he liked it a lot, so he picked it up. And once he did, then it became a big hit. In those days, hits happened quite often by accident, by who sang them. Mm. Starting in the 1950s, with the singer-songwriter era, they became indistinguishable from each other, the singer and the song. But when I grew up and was writing the theater, although this was in 1970, but 73, but nevertheless, it was a different matter. And, Hello, Dolly became famous only because Louis Armstrong picked it up and then his recording, and then everybody recorded it. So that's the way hit songs were made in the musical theater in the days of the singer-songwriter.
It seems to me that a lot of your music, it's difficult to stand alone because it is so specific to the program, the show itself.
Yes, that's true. That's something from Oscar I got, which is write specifically for the character. He said each song should be a little play in itself with a sort of premise and then, well, it's like sonata form, a premise and then a development and then a conclusion, and that every song should progress from one point to another, or it should not just be static, et cetera, et cetera. That all has to do with character and situation. So you're right, even Sending the Clowns. I get letters still from people saying, I like the song, but what's it about? Mm-hmm. Well, if you know what the situation is, you don't have to ask that question. But if you don't, you wonder, what is this Sending the Clown stuff?
And yet it can still stand alone very, very well.
It does. Question about it. Yeah. But that's unusual.
Yeah. I have to take a break in a moment, but with you, what comes first, the words or the music?
Oh, they come together. The answer to that question, which is in a show I wrote called Merrily Wrong, is the contract. But they come simultaneously. I mean, the way I write, I've discussed the scene endlessly and the shows endlessly with the book writer. And we decide where a song should go, and generally what should it be about, and generally what will it accomplish. And then sometimes I can get a refrain idea, refrain being a repeated phrase that holds the song together, or I will fiddle at the piano and get something either melodic or harmonic, particularly harmonic, that suggests the temperature of the scene, and from that can perhaps get a melodic idea, which in its rhythm will suggest some kind of lyrical phrase. I'm very into inflection. You can get melodic ideas from the way, just way people talk. And so sometimes you merely write down a sentence, like write down a sentence, write down a sentence. That right away suggests a rhythm and a melody with a flow. And if you listen to some Steve Reich music, he does that specifically. He makes music out of the way people talk. He takes snippets of the way people talk and by manipulating them, makes music out of them, real music.
Real music indeed. We're talking with Stephen Sondheim. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. We have to take a break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Thank you for listening to this St. Louis on the Air podcast supported by University College at Washington University, with undergraduate and graduate programs, part-time, evening, and online. University College at Washington University, offering world-class education within reach.
And welcome back to our conversation with Stephen Sondheim, composer, lyricist, well-known for so many wonderful shows that he has put together. And getting back to our conversation about performances, it's also been my observation. You've corrected me about just about everything I've said today. But it seems to me that what you write oftentimes is very, very difficult for performers to sing.
That I have that reputation. And yet, sometimes it's true that sometimes the songs are difficult. But if you talk to the performers who've sung my stuff, what they will generally tell you is it sounds difficult until you start working on it. Mm-hmm. And when you start working on it, because I pride myself on being meticulous about giving places to breathe, ways to use the lips and the teeth to pronounce things, at speed of speech, all that. And what sounds difficult quite often turns out to be not. Sometimes the musical aspect of the songs I write is difficult in the sense that there are leaps and sort of little surprises that the tunes don't quite go where you expect them to. And I don't do that perversely. I try to keep things fresh. I think it's very good, not just in songwriting, but in theater writing or any kind of narrative art, to be a step ahead of your audience. If they know what you're going to say next, they're very likely to get bored. And if they don't know what you're going to say next, they may be startled and a little discombobulated, but that's the way to do it. So sometimes I do that in a musical phrase.
I'm going to play another clip now. We can talk about it afterwards. This is Green Finch and Linnet Bird, performed by Sarah Rice from the original cast of Sweeney Todd. Let's hear a little of that.
Green Finch and Linnet Bird, Nightingale, Blackbird, how is it you sing? How can you jubilate sitting in cages, never taking wing?
That is Sarah Rice performing from the original cast in Sweeney Todd. A couple of things about that, talking about difficult songs to sing. That sounds to me like one that is just that. It sounds difficult and also operatic.
Well, it's not difficult to sing. Of course, the trill is an operatic device that you have to know how to do as a singer. She was not a particularly trained singer. She was just a girl who had been in some musicals. So, and that's the proof is in the pudding. It's not hard to sing. It sounds operatic partly because of where her voice is placed and because of the style of the song. But as far as a melody goes, no, it's not hard to sing.
How do you get into a story like the story of Sweeney Todd, which is just brutal, murder, mayhem?
Well, murder, mayhem, and humor. I went to London. for the first production of Gypsy there, and I heard there was this Grand Guignol play at a theater just outside of London, and I'd always wanted to see Grand Guignol, and I went there, and it wasn't Grand Guignol at all. It was, in fact, Sweeney Todd, a straight play version. Mm-hmm. Sweeney Todd is a story that's been around since 1845 and has gone through many changes, been done. It was very popular during the 19th century in different versions. Different actors would write their own versions of the story. And finally, this version was written by a guy named Christopher Bond, who was, in fact, an actor. And so I went to see it, and I didn't expect to see this, and I saw it, and I thought, "Woo, this would make a musical that would be fun," because you know, yes, it is about murder and all that, but it's a melodrama, mm-hmm. and it doesn't pretend to be real. It's a fable. That's what a melodrama is, and I'm gonna love melodrama. I loved melodramatic movies, and I love melodramatic plays, and I thought it would sing. And so I got all the versions of it from 1845 to 1970, whenever it was. And I got Hugh Wheeler, who was a Britisher, with whom I'd written a show, Little Night Music. And so we did it together.
Well, it seemed to work. to work out okay.
Well, I'll tell you why it works. I'm not immodest or modest about my own work. It's the story. It is a wonderful plot. You really want to know what's going to happen next, and when it does, you're startled or shocked or whatever it is. But it absolutely holds together as a plot. And not very many shows, particularly musicals, have that kind of narrative force. They don't have plots as strong as that, because that's not what they're about. But I got, so that's really what makes that show work so well. And it works on every level, on a professional level, amateur level, school levels. It's because of the story.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls. We have some listeners who want to talk to Stephen Sondheim. We'll begin with Bob calling from St. Louis. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to refer to one of my most exciting theatrical moments in any musical, and that was when not having early in the run of A Little Night Music, I heard for the first time Soon, Now, and Later, and was awed. It certainly does everything that Mr. Sondheim says it does in terms of advancing the characters, but the musicality, the way it fit together, my jaw dropped.
Thank you for your call. A jaw-dropping episode.
Well, thanks for the compliment. I'm very proud of that song because of the puzzle aspect of it, of how the words now, soon, and later are used and then reused in different contexts. And so that was a lot of fun to work out. The real problem in working it out was how to make the three tunes go together, because for those listeners who don't know, each song is a separate song, now, later, soon. Or in a different order. It's later first, and then now, and then soon. And then the three songs come together. Now, ordinarily, you can tell when a couple of tunes are going to come together and play at the same time, but not in this case, because the songs are so different. And that was what I wanted to do, is I thought, nobody's going to know that these three songs are going to go together. Well, guess what? When I started, they didn't go together. And so it took a good deal of working out. And because I like puzzles, this worked out. There was a solution, and that's what. So I'm glad you appreciated that, because that's exactly what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call, Bob. You know, you've mentioned puzzles a couple of times, and puzzles to me oftentimes suggest math. And I always hear, I'm not a musician, but math and music go very, very closely together.
Math, music, and medicine, the three M's, they go together. I was going to major in math when I went to college. Oh. And took this elective course in music my freshman year and met under Robert Barrow, and he changed my life. And I decided not to major in math, but to major in music.
Yeah. Where does the medicine come in?
Talk to doctors. Many doctors are either amateur musicians, semi-professional. Hospitals have orchestras. They just, this is my opinion, and maybe some doctor would say nonsense. But I think the three things go together.
Yeah, I've never seen them connected that way, but it is interesting the way you point that out. Another call. This one involves our friend Jerry from O'Fallon, Missouri. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good afternoon. It's quite an honor to be able to address you. I've been enjoying your music for decades, and there's a kind of subtle intelligence to both your music and lyrics that I think bears like repeat listening before you kind of really get the entire perspective. And I'm sure it's very difficult to write songs for a musical play that have a life outside of that or outside of the context. And, of course, I'm a big jazz fan, so I was always a fan of heard both Stan Kenton and Benny Goodman perform Sendin' the Clowns. And, in fact, about 40 years ago when Benny Goodman was working with a small group, he normally would play another tune from A Little Night Music, You Must Meet My Wife, which was also very effective in his style. So thank you for all the art you brought us.
Thank you. And I was hoping you'd mention that his version of You Must Meet My Wife is just wonderful. And most are not taken up by jazz musicians for the very simple reason, because I asked them, that I use jazz harmonies. There's nothing for them to improvise on. The best kinds of tunes for jazz, particularly trios, are songs that are simple musically so that they can start to explore that and expand it and, like a blossom, get bigger and bigger into a huge flower. And my stuff, I'm so influenced by jazz harmonies that they're usually built into the songs, and therefore I've done the work for them, and therefore there's no fun for them. At least that's what I've been told more than once.
Yeah. One of the great interpreters of your songs, as I see it anyway, is Bernadette Peters. I've seen a lot of her material. Would you agree that she's pretty good at interpreting what you write?
Oh, yeah, she is indeed. She's wonderful. There are a couple of singers who really like to do my stuff, and she's one of them.
Yeah, I'd like to play a clip of her singing just a little bit. Losing My Mind is the name of the song. It's a pretty song, and we're doing it because one of our producers sang it years ago, and she wants to hear it again. The sun comes up, the coffee cup. Where did the coffee cup come from?
Well, it's a woman living her whole day. And so the sun comes up, she gets out of bed, and she has a cup of coffee. The song just traverses an entire day. You go from A to B to C to D, and you start in the morning, you end up going to bed. And so that's where it comes from. It's the natural thing that you get when you wake up.
Well, it makes a lot of sense when you hear from the composer and the lyricist. Well, let me tell you that. A couple of things I wanted to talk about with regard to what's going on in the world of musicals today. Number one, Hamilton. What do you make of that and its success?
I don't talk at all ever about any living composer's work. Forgive me.
All right. Well, I was getting to the point that it's simply, it seems like it's a new chapter and a new direction for
well, the... Certainly the use of rap in the theater is new. Yeah. And that's what's exciting about it.
Another element that's much in the news these days, including here in St. Louis, is and this is connected to you certainly with West Side Story, is a number of protests have been held, including one at Kent State University just today, because they're not using the appropriate ethnic people in these roles. You have any thoughts about that?
No, first of all, I didn't even find out about that till last night. That's been done before. The most famous example of that was a production of Miss Saigon, the original production in New York, where there were great protests because Jonathan Pryce was not an Asian, and he was the leading character. He was supposed to be an Asian handler. And I just, you know, that kind of protest, I just find sort of silly. I don't see, just, you know, if you carry that to its extreme, then you'd have to say that an actress couldn't be played by anybody, an actress, okay, and that a mother couldn't be played by somebody who hadn't been a mother. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Okay, fair enough. We have a couple more, little time, and a couple of more questions here. Ashley writes, I'm getting ready to go to London this weekend to see the new production of Company. Can you talk about the process of rewriting the show to star a woman? What should I look for in particular?
This was an idea of the director, whose name is Marianne Elliott. And because I think she is certainly one of, if not the best directors in the English-speaking language, I said yes. I have said before, I would, if she asked me to do the telephone directory, I'd musicalize it for her. And so it was her idea. And I started examining. I thought it'd be fairly easy to change in a way, in the sense that you change, you know, he to she, and in the pronouns and the lyrics and all that. But then I realized it has to do much more subtly and much more extensively with attitude. There is a difference, obviously, between a woman of 35 feeling the way she does in the play and a man of 35, which is what it was originally. So I did quite a lot of rewriting, not big stuff, tweaking here and there, changing lyrics, and also because George Firth, who wrote the book, is no longer with us, I did some of that in the book too. And it just started previews last week in London, and it works very well.
Our time's winding down. Are you working on anything now?
Yeah, I'm working with a playwright named David Ives, who, for those who go to the theater a lot, he had actually last year he had the play that was done most all across the country, the United States, called Venus in Furs. But he's primarily a humorous writer, a humorist who writes short plays. Anyway, he and I have known each other a while. We've been trying to get together to do a musical. We started one. And it didn't work out for numerous reasons. And so we decided to take two movies by Louis Buñuel, one called The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie and the other one called The Exterminating Angel. Both movies, in different ways, are about people trying to find a place to eat. That's what happens. People try to find a place to eat. And so we've combined them, and we've finished the first act, and David's finished the second act, and I'm about a third of the way into the second act.
Does it have a working title?
No, we're desperately trying to find a title. In fact, we've batted titles back and forth over the last couple of years, and just before I went to London last week, I collated all of them. We have over 50 titles that we've considered, and we're not really satisfied with any of them.
Well, when can I be thinking about getting tickets?
Well, the earliest it would be done, and it's possible, depending on whether we meet the deadlines, would be next April. But I don't know whether we'll meet that deadline.
We'll look forward to that, Stephen Sondheim. It's been a great pleasure having a chance to talk to you. Continued success. Many more years of wonderful music from Stephen Sondheim.
Thank you so much.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you.